After lunch, as we watched the rain pour down and the premature darkness roll up, he said in his searching, personal way, "Love's a part. Who would you like to see coming up the drive?" I hesitated a moment, and he supplied the answer. Virginia, of course.
Virginia Woolf, of course, is one of the 20th century's most famous writers, but perhaps joining her up the drive would be her sister, Vanessa. In recent years, Vanessa Bell's work has been the subject of the Dulwich Picture Gallery's retrospective in 2017, which showcased the breadth of her creative work through paintings, ceramics, fabrics, and photographs. Bell was a pivotal member of the Bloomsbury Group, who were a core ensemble of 10 artists, which included Clive Bell, whose recollection we just heard, art critic Roger Fry, post-impressionist painter Duncan Grant, and writer Ian Forster. Hi Anastasia, welcome to the podcast. I'm so excited to talk to you today about your work on the Vanessa Bell Archive and find out more about your perspective on photography archives and making.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really excited to talk to you about, Vanessa Bell and archives in general. I feel like specifically Vanessa Bell Photograph, I'm really excited to talk about it because I think that not that many people know about it yet, and I really love her images, and I think for me it was a really important collection to work with because it had a huge impact on my career, but also had an impact just, you know, as an artist to myself. It really inspired me again at a time that I didn't feel so inspired. It's probably one of the first collections that I worked with as an archivist where I felt really passionate about, you know, the subject, and I really fell in love with her.
That's really amazing. I can't wait to hear all about it. Well, maybe you want to start with just telling us a bit about Vanessa Bell and your experiences in her archive.
So I work with Vanessa Bell Photographs at the Tate Archive. And so, I mean, Vanessa Bell was a British painter, which probably for many years was most known to be Virginia Woolf's sister, but she's also a really famous painter and a wonderful photographer. She took photograph her whole life, and it's really something that I think more now we are aware of, but for many years it wasn't really something that people talked about. But she had photographs from, you know, living in London, and then throughout her life. So I've worked with photographs that will be mostly taken in Charleston, so it really gave you a really great insight of how her life was in Charleston and the kind of life she made for herself with Duncan Grant, Clive Bell, Roger Fry, her sister, and the three kids she had, Julian, Quentin, and Angelica.
So really a proper domestic creation then, Charleston. It's definitely about building your family and creating a place that they can live and create together.
Yeah, I think it's exactly what Charleston was. I think that's why it's so beautiful, because it's just such a perfect mix of their family life, and also even just their life as adults. They were definitely eccentric. They all fall in love with each other, and they all kind of shared relationship, and I think they were allowed to be very creative in that sense, but they also had the kids around that were able to create a lot of art. Alongside this, you had the career of Vanessa Bell and Duncan Grant, which they painted this entire house and used pottery and ceramic and to make it a home, but in such a creative way. And I think, you know, they both had their studio there, so they could really fully be themselves and be artists as much as they wanted. They could just spend their entire day do that, and then also when they wanted a break, just kind of paint the chairs or the table and all those things. You know, along the years as well, it became really the work of love, because so many people worked in their house. So it was mostly Duncan Grant and Vanessa Bell, but you had some sculpture from her son in the garden at the end, and then also they've created a little theatre sort of scene with, I think, an old caravan or something like this in the garden, and, you know, they all made fake costumes, and then I think all that together created a really, really cosy, warm, creative space to be.
And so how does the creative space of Charleston as this sort of fluid, experimental, familial place link up to the work they did with the Omega Workshop?
I think it's very similar in a way, because the Omega Workshop, which was created by Roger Fry, was really about rejecting the traditional distinction between the fine and decorative art, and about changing all those assumptions. And I think that what he was doing was really, that workshop was selling, you know, furniture, fabric, accessories, but all made by artists, which I think it's exactly what Charleston is, because it is decorative art, what she's done. I mean, it is painting tablecloth and sort of doors and doorknobs and all those sort of thing, which can be seen exactly. It's exactly what he was doing with this workshop. It was a lot of motif, and I think it was a way to close that, you know, that space between fine and decorative art. It's just art, and it's just something that you could have in your home.
It's the ultimate self-expression, isn't it, really?
It is the best way you could just kind of show your personality as an artist in your home.
Sounds amazing. So do you think Vanessa Bell's personality comes out in the archive then?
Vanessa Bell was very funny. She had a very different personality. She was very funny, very outspoken, very, I think, loud. And you read letters that she wrote, and that she's just really, she's a very funny person, I think.
I wanted to ask you as well, did you go to the Dulwich Picture Gallery's retrospective?
Well, I mean, I know that the photographs that they're showing the exhibition, they were mostly from the Tate. So those are the photographs I've worked with. And I mean, they're stunning. I feel like I'm not the biggest fan of Patti Smith as a writer. I really love her as a singer. And I think she, you know, she's talented in many ways. I think she's like a great performer. The personality does, it kind of makes sense, because I see Patti Smith in my head anyway as this kind of bohemian, really kind of outspoken woman that, you know, really lives fully her life and ideals. And that's why I think of Vanessa Bell. I think Vanessa Bell was like this kind of free spirit coming from a very aristocratic family, but then really breaking through from it and making sure that she could be the person that she wanted to be. She was definitely punk, if you think about it, because she really rejected everything that she was from. And I don't think it was easy at that time. I think even the way they were living was really not accepted at the time it was done, especially not for women.
Yeah, to be choosing your own path in that way.
Yeah, and to prove that you could be a mother, a wife, a lover, an amazing artist, all those things that at that time were really taboo. Like, you could be one of those things, but it's never quite all of it, you know, especially at this time. You always hear stories about, oh, she was the lovers of this person, but then you never talk about their art. It's what you focus on. But then for Vanessa Bell, I mean, I think people focus on all those aspects of her life. You know, the fact that she was married to Clive Bell, but also had an affair with Roger Fry, but also Duck and Ground was, you know, probably the biggest love of her life. All those facts are extremely important, and people talk about this a lot. But they also talk a lot about her painting, her house, Charleston, you know, the legacy she's left as an artist. So it's kind of interesting. And also we've also, you know, got the aspect of hearing from the kids about Vanessa Bell as a mother. So all those things, they all like kind of goes together, which I don't think it was the case for many women at that time.
Yeah, definitely not. It's like a radical domestic existence, isn't it?
It really is, yeah. And that's what I think of Patti Smith, although I don't know very much about her, but I think she fits in that category.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of framing Vanessa Bell, actually. I've never thought of her as about quite how radical her choices and the way she lived were.
Yeah, I found her really radical in so many things. I think we forget about how hard it must have been to do those choices at that time as being a woman, and also being from such an important family. You know, I think it's very difficult to break from it, but it's pretty rare. And actually, I feel like to some extent, Virginia was never able to fully remove herself from the aristocracy of her family. But then I felt like Vanessa Bell definitely succeeded in that. She had a very, very, very different life.
Do you have a favorite piece from the Vanessa Bell archive?
Big into every image she took of Duck and Grant, but also I absolutely love Duck and Grant. So, but actually, that is the reason I love Duck and Grant is because of her. So it's the way she took photograph of him. I found him so beautiful, but also there's just something about him that's really mysterious in her photograph, and it feels very intimate. I really like that, especially there's some images that she took towards the end of her life, which was actually not in Charleston, but in the house in the south of France, and they were in this sort of garden, and he's just sitting with a cat, and this is such a beautiful image. It looks so quiet and so peaceful, but they just look so old, and because I've worked from the image that starts so early on, they're very young, to just see the evolution and how close they still are. I feel like this image, it shows that really well, and I love that photograph.
So really capturing the intimacy through the lens is what appeals to you the most.
Everyone she has taken photograph of, she knows them really, really well, and I think that's something that you can only do when you know them so well, to have this sort of natural moment captured.
Mm. It's interesting as well, because sometimes you might think of a camera as a distancing tool, that there's something between you and your subject, and in the same way in the archive, sometimes you might think of those objects as being distant from the person that made them, but actually in both, it's the intimacy and the voice and the humor and the personality that you're really bringing out of the pieces in front of you.
Yeah, totally. I agree. I think that's really, you can't remove it from the artist. I think it's not something that put distance between you. I think a camera if anything, I think it makes you closer to the person you're taking a photograph, because you're able to look at little detail that I think sometime if you didn't have a camera with you, you might not see that details, but that forces you to see those details, which means that you become even closer. And I think the same about, archive, I think, are a great way to be close to people and to understand, a person better, because it gives you so much information about the idea behind what was done or why was it done. It kind of tells you about the tone. Some people, like, as I said, I could tell that Vanessa Bell was very funny from her letter, which I wouldn't know that by just looking at her photograph, but I can tell you that by, reading her writing.
Yeah, it's bringing a full picture together of the artistic lifespan. And I just want to go back to this image of Duncan Grant and Vanessa Bell in their later years. And it's just incredible that you can really trace her whole life through the archive. I think often we tend to maybe focus a bit too much on the Bloomsbury years or the height of the early 20th century and the movements that these people were involved in. But they lived long lives, and that's kind of beautiful that that's also recorded and kept for posterity.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's sometimes a shame, because they are, it's a blessing and a curse, I guess. The fact that the Bloomsbury set is so famous and people are obsessed with what it meant to be part of that group and everything that they've done. But I think we forget that they are individuals, and what's very beautiful, I agree with you, is to just sort of see them and evolved. I think even the artwork, even the painting, you could see an evolution that's really, really quite moving, I think. And in her photograph, you can absolutely see her whole life. You can see her when she used to be very young and with her sister living in London. You can see her, when she was starting to understand her camera, when she was taking photograph of McCarthy being nude in the studio in London. And it's kind of like young and playful, and you can tell that she's kind of, just trying around and being very young. And then you could also see when the kids start coming and how the images change around them. And then towards the end, you also see more photographs of her and Duncan Grant, for example, where they are in the garden having a meal, having wine, and you know they got those hats, and you can tell they're very tan and they're old, and it's just so beautiful. It's so personal, and it's definitely, you can just kind of imagine a little bit what her life was.
I think that's so lovely. And I mean, Vanessa Bell lived a long life. She passed away in 1961. And, you know, we think of the 60s as the free love baby boomers, but Vanessa and Duncan and Roger and Clive, they were, you know, doing that way before.
Oh, way before. They were very, very ahead of the time.
They got the free love thing down.
They did. I mean, I think that's obviously something that's really cool about them, I guess, is that they all loved each other, but it's complex. I mean, yeah. They definitely all... I think it probably wasn't very nice, actually, for the kids. Actually, I've never read Angelica Garnett's book, which I really want to, but I haven't had the chance yet. But I know that she said many times that she thought it was very hard to grow up in Charleston. And she felt like it was very hard to be around those adults because they were so absorbed in their own lives and their own love stories, and that they kind of forgot about the kids.
Mm.
So I guess, you know, that's also another side of the story. It probably wasn't that easy to be part of that sort of free movement, but I definitely think that they were free and very gender fluid and honest, you know, with what they wanted.
And what other archives do you work with at the Tate?
I mean, I've worked with quite a few archives. I've worked with another archive, actually, from an artist that was not part of the Bloomsbury as we could, you know, as per se, but she was gravitating around them, and she knew them from Dora Carrington. It's Dorothy Brett. He was an amazing British painter who actually started, you know, in that sort of circle, but then her career really, really changed direction because she moved to Mexico. Mm. And so her painting are very different from everything that has been done in the Bloomsbury set. It's very different, the colors are very different, but then also just the way she would draw people, obviously it's a complete different style. And I absolutely love her paintings. I think she's one of the most talented. I'm working with Whitechapel Gallery. They're going to have a show about Ellie Nagar. Do you know her?
Oh my God, amazing.
Yeah, I thought you would. So they're going to have a lot of her archives there, and stuff about Hepworth as well, with linking to Ellie Nagar.
Oh my God, but, that's exciting.
That's going to be really cool. I'm looking forward to seeing this, and it's going to be in Whitechapel, so we can, it's near both of us. So
we can walk.
We can walk there.
Do you work on the Eileen Agar archive as well?
I've not worked on the Ellie Nagar archive. My colleague Victoria worked on the Ellie Nagar archive, but I have looked into her archive a bit because I did a show and tell about women in photography, actually with that same colleague, and we decided to show images of Ellie Nagar, and so I was able to kind of look at all of her images that she's taken. We've got some really beautiful photographs at the Tate archive, actually, and yeah, so that's how. And then I think, you know, those are basically loans item, so it's also not something I normally deal with, but because everyone at the minute is furloughed, I've just kind of been brought into it.
Amazing. So the same as in the same Eileen Agar who did textile design,
yeah,
and painting.
Yeah, yeah, the same. Oh yeah, my God. Yeah, that Eileen Agar.
Oh my God, that's gonna be amazing.
That's gonna be a really good exhibition, I think.
And when does that happen?
Well, I mean, I don't know because of what's happening. I mean, everything is going to be changed. Yeah. Every program is going to have to be completely rethinked. So I'm not quite sure. But, you know, soon enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, something to look forward to.
The selection you make is a huge part of what makes you an artist. So, for example, when I took photographs, I know that I would, you know, often share it with the person I've taken in photos of the people I've worked with. And then I would just tell them, you know, the one I'm selecting to show to the people. And it's kind of interesting because more often they never selected the same images that I would have selected. And I think it's an interesting point is that what I'm selecting is also part of me being an artist. But then you keep those images that you've done. You don't throw them away. So those are things that usually are part of an archive. And that's quite interesting because then you can also learn more about what they wanted to show about themselves and what they decided was best for their, you know, their best photograph, their best painting.
Mm, I saw an amazing exhibition at the CO Photography Gallery in Berlin, and it was the Magnum contact sheets. So all of these famous images, and you saw every other shot that was taken of it and the sort of one that was chosen. And it really did illuminate the process to me in a way that I hadn't quite realized before. And I suppose, especially with photography, that is a curation as well, isn't it? Of picking the moment that you've captured.
Yeah, exactly. It's curating your work. But then when you have an archive, you know, everything is in there. So it's not curated. Because an archivist won't remove things. You won't remove it. You won't chuck away thing, you know. So you will. You might put it in a different order, but normally you don't. I mean, you try to really stick with, you know, the way it was found or chronological order. But you don't really remove things. So in a way, you're not really curating it.
How do you curate the archive for a show?
So you have to remove the knowledge you have of the artist and try to make it a little bit more accessible in a way that, for example, I know the photographer Vanessa Bell really well. So if you were asking me to show you five photographs, the one I would want to show you or the one that means the most to me, because I just think they're stunning, but I don't know if that's what would be the best to represent her work to someone that I have no idea who she is. So you would need to do a different thought process, if that makes sense, and kind of remove your knowledge and put yourself in, you know, the position of someone that doesn't know anything about the artist. So that's really important, I think, when you create any kind of exhibition, but especially archive, because in archive it can be a little bit obscure. You can have this letter that you get so excited about, but really, if you don't know the artist, it means nothing.
Especially with people like in the Bloomsday group, it's sort of assumed knowledge, I think, sometimes about who these people are and how they connected.
Yeah.
But actually, it's such a sprawling, connected group. You could never know everything about them, could you?
That's the thing, it's so complicated. There's so many people and they're all so can you say intertwined? I mean, they're all like linked with each other, but it's so many people. It's like Leighton Strachey, Clive Bell, David Garnett. If you start doing this, people are like, what? But obviously you've worked with, you know, the archive for weeks, months, sometimes years. So you're very familiar with those people. You know it really well.
Yeah, you know all their back and forth in the letters.
You're like, oh, of course, they were together at that time. And yes, he was part of the Omega, like, you know, studio they had, or they've worked on this gallery together. But when you don't know, it just sounds really frightening. And also, I think they all had so many side projects, like the Friday Club and all those things. And then it starts to get even more, I think, intimidating if you don't know who they are.
In a generation of renters, do you think a project like Charleston could exist today?
I don't think it could exist the same way. I think there were time where it was a lot easier to buy a house and therefore to have complete freedom in what you want to do inside it. I think that's, you know, an amazing creative way to do your house that comes with the possibility to really own your house and not even to really think about selling it. I think as well now these days, because it's so hard to buy, you want to make sure that if you also have to sell it, you know, it's easy to sell. So you're maybe not going to paint flowers and panels all over your walls.
I suppose it's hard enough to put up pictures when your landlord's telling you to keep the walls bare.
Exactly. Like sometimes you can't even put just like photograph on your wall. And, you know, that's such a, they remove such a big aspect of creativity. You're not allowed to even paint wall. I mean, I wish I could paint my walls in colors. Everything is so white. This is not how I would live if I could. But then, you know, you don't own the place and very few people do own the place. And I guess the people that do, yes, they could probably create the same way. But then I don't think it's accessible for that many people these days. Although saying that, I think we should, you know, be honest with the fact that, as I've mentioned earlier, she was from a very wealthy family. She's always been very wealthy, although she had not much money at that time. Clive Bell had a lot of money. So they were, you know, when they moved into Charleston, they did have the cook, they had a maid. They, you know, they didn't move just them and created that place. They also had a lot of people taking care of the kids and of all the other things, which meant they could really focus as well on just, you know, creating that place.
Well, also, I suppose, in a way, breaking down the class barriers that she faced as an upper class person who couldn't necessarily be a creative woman is one thing. But then there's other class boundaries in terms of working class people not having the access to their own home that they can't then create in that same way.
Yeah.
So it's quite interesting how it traverses both lines, really.
Completely.
For yeah. people like us, we can't dream of creating something like Charleston.
Yeah.
Although I was going to say, I wonder if the way our personality can come out in our houses is actually through buying and engaging with craft a bit more. Like you buy a little ceramic figure that you can put on a, you know, that can move across the mantelpiece, or you might buy a rug or a blanket that you can throw across the horrible
yes.
furniture that your landlord's
yes.
put in.
Yeah. Little trinkets. I totally yeah. agree. I think it's such a millennial thing to have all those little trinkets.
But it's because we're so disparate. Like we're never
yeah
I don't think I've lived in a house for longer than a year, and even then we weren't allowed to put things up on the walls, so we had all our pictures like framed but just leaning against the walls in a sort of haphazard manner. But it's actually the system that you have to live in, right? Like I wasn't allowed my bike yeah. in the hallway, I wasn't allowed pictures on the wall, but I could go and buy one of those ceramic ghosts from what's it called,
yeah, I totally
Good
agree
Hood, and put that up.
I love it,
spending all my money on ceramic ghosts.
I mean, to be fair, I totally agree. I think I'm a bit naughty. Like I just never, quite frankly, I never cared about what the landlord said. I've always put, you know, pictures on my walls. I know, actually, I think I've always lived very long times in places, actually. So I guess that's a bit of a difference. But also, I've always, as soon as I moved somewhere, it's always been the first thing for me that I've done. I've always made the house very homely, whether it was a room in like a house sharing or like a room in a warehouse, or I've always made sure that it felt really cozy. But I know that's like quite rare, actually. But I totally agree with you, because I know that when we moved, just Alex and I, for me, it was such an excitement. I was like, oh my God, I can do whatever I want. In a way that obviously, you know, I couldn't paint the wall, as I mentioned. But like you were saying, the freedom, because obviously we had more space. And so the freedom of putting rugs, quilts, you know, pictures, plants, everything. It just felt so freeing, and it made me feel much more creative, actually. And it really helped me to feel more in my own bubble, in my own zone, which is what really inspires me when I create or want to even think about it. But I definitely agree with you that I think it is such a good way of thinking about it. The reason we're all into having a nice mug or, you know, all those little things, it's because that's kind of all we can have.
Yeah, when you're so transient and you don't rent from one year to the other the same place, the only thing you can do is pack up your bits and bobs and take them to the next
but
house.
I also wonder if it's like linked to Instagram in a way that there's such a huge renewed interest in decoration, isn't it? So many like program about it and on the hot list these days. And I mean, I'm totally guilty of it. Like it's literally my passion. But I feel like now we do a lot of this kind of like photograph shot, you know, where you just see like the fireplace and it's not even, it used to be the selfie used to be cool, but now I feel like it's like the fireplace that you take from a cute angle, and then you can see like the candles and like the sort of ceramic and jewelry memory. And so, like, I think it becomes kind of important, isn't it? Because now you curate the way it looks, so you curate your own home.
It's I love that idea that the mantelpiece has took over from the selfie.
I think it does. Oh, maybe it's just because I'm obsessed with it, and so my algorithm just show me that all the time.
Could be that as well.
It could. It's hard to tell these days. Everything is very, it's removed from your own knowledge. You think that's what you like, but it's not really what you like.
Yeah, the algorithm's curating your taste. You've got no
say. Yeah, I think so, because really for me, it's all I see. I see so many pictures of really fireplace, like just like the top of you know, like a table and those great cushions and the lighting. And I see so many of this, and I'm like, wow, people are just so into decorating now. But then maybe that's just not the case.
No, I think it is. I think you're right. I mean, even just the rise of sites like Etsy, and during lockdown, it's been the biggest thing is that people are taking up craft again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Slowing things down a little bit and working more with the time that they've got. I think it's very telling, really, that we're moving back towards that. I mean, what makes you want to start a craft, do you think?
I mean, I think there's different reasons. You know, I personally, for myself, I like the end result. And I think that's also why I choose specific craft. Like, I feel like I might not completely fail at it. I find it really creative in a way that, for me, I always loved making things with my hand, and like, you know, just doing something that's not just sitting and watching, you know, my computer or things like that. I always find it really interesting, and I feel like because I've always taken photographs and I've always used analog cameras, it's such a long process, and it always was the one thing I loved about it. But it also means that it's not necessarily something you could just do all the time, and also it's something that I've been personally struggling a little bit with in terms of being inspired, and you know, maybe I felt like I was a bit stuck at times. And so I really wanted to find other things that brought me the same amount of joy and calmness and focus that I can feel when I take a photo. And that's what I felt with some of the crafts I've chosen. You know, obviously I like to do clay and ceramic, and then I started doing a bit of embroidery. And those are very similar in a way that they're kind of very calming. You have to be focused. You know, the end result, I mean, there's high chances they will be okay. They might not be great, but they will probably be okay.
Well, and also I found I took up cross stitching, and it's not great. It's very average, but that's also okay. And I kind
that's
of love
not
that.
True.
No, it is. It's fine.
I really like it.
No, but it's, you know, it's not. I've found something that isn't about the end product being perfect. I think that's been a really freeing experience. Why do you think creating a home is so important?
Well, I do think that that's our generation, isn't it? Everything is so fast. Nothing feels very secure. We don't have very much, all of us. For me anyway, I don't really have very much. And for me to have a home, it's so comforting. You know, it's something that I really, really put a lot of effort in it. And I think I personally feel like I struggle a lot with anxiety, and I get really depressed, I get really low, I get really worried. And to be in a house that surrounded by things that I care for, that I like, it makes me feel very good, and it kind of reassures me, and it feels very secure.
It's really empowering as well that you can make the things that you want as well. It kind of cuts
yes.
out that idea that everything has to cost you money,
yeah.
or it has to cost you effort, or it has to cost you your sanity sometimes. Instead, you can just invest a little bit in the materials and then make something for yourself, basically.
And it's also so satisfying, isn't it, when you look at something you've done. It's just a bit different. I mean, it's great to, you know, spend £30 on a nice
ceramic
sculpture.
Ghost.
Yeah, or mug. But then when you do it, it's just, there's something about it. It just makes you feel really good, and it just feels very, you're very proud. I think it's great, like, to look at a box that you've made, or, I don't know, I think it has something very different to it. Mm. And it tells you a story as well. So I think, again, it becomes more like an object that really means a lot to you.
Yeah, it was making me think about going on to that distinction between art. Someone who's making at home.
Yeah.
I suppose the difference between a professional cross stitcher and myself is that what they produce potentially has more artistic value.
Yeah, I think it definitely is still today reasoning with what's, you know, with the way we think of it. Well, I suppose the way we think of art and the way we think of craft.
Like art is a one-off and
yeah,
craft is multiple.
Yeah, I think that's often people would say that, isn't it? It's like it's art should be a one, like one precious thing, and then craft not really, not as precious, and you can have so many of them.
Sorry.
Unless, yeah, it's true though. I think you should leave that in the podcast.
Some gripes at Jeff Koons. Was there a distinction between Vanessa Bell's painting versus the work that she was producing at Charleston? Did she have that distinction between what is art and what is a handicraft?
No, I don't think she did, actually. You know, I don't think at all. I think she sees everything as art and creative. I don't think she looked at her painting in a different way that she looked at the way she painted the panel of her door. I think she saw it all the same. But then again, she is an artist, and she sees herself as an artist, and she's seen by other as an artist. Because of that, no matter what she does, it's regarded as art. And it goes back to this whole idea of what makes the piece art. Is it because you decided that you're an artist, or because people see you as that? There's also, you know, the historical aspect of it is, you know, in retrospect, you know who she is, you know what happened to her, you know her whole career.
Do you think the lines between what different mediums are much more blurred these days?
Yeah, I definitely think like it makes a huge difference now that you could just do many things. It doesn't have to be, you're not put in one box. You could just, I mean, you know, you could do so many different kind of craft, and they could still like fit with who you are and your art practice. It doesn't sound different. I think as well, what I wanted to say earlier when we said, you know, what is the distinction between an artist and someone just at home making craft? I wonder as well if it's because, you know, in the past, a lot of the craft, they were more seen as like a historical document. You know, the way that people were doing craft, it was more to document something rather than to make it for the sole purpose of maybe, you know, the aesthetic of it.
The question of historical value, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Are you thinking of something like the Bayeux tapestry?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm thinking of. I think it's like a perfect example. Definitely. That has been an old question, isn't it? People, I think, are still in debate whether it's art or a historical document.
I read a really amazing chapter on the tapestry. It was saying about how the different women that worked on that tapestry all had a different section, would have had to make do with what threads they had available, colours change halfway through part of it, or you can tell when a different seamstress or sewist takes up a different figure. And there's so many different people that have had a hand in making that document. And yet they're all anonymous. We'll never know who those people were.
Who they were.
And in a way, the reason it has to be framed as more as a historical document is because we don't know who the makers were. And what we do know is the context of the battle or the context of the kings and queens involved. But the actual makers are lost to history, really. Except the marks that they've made on this tapestry, which is, you know, an amazing feat.
I mean, this is such an interesting comment, actually, because then again, it all goes back to the process, isn't it? It goes back from the people from the beginning, before even starting to do something, deciding that they are doing it for art, or that they are seeing themselves as artists. But then obviously, if, you know, a lot of people are doing it and they are, it's anonymous, then that removes entirely this whole idea that you're making it because of art. So therefore, it's easier to call it a historical document. Even though I personally still think I think it's both, actually. I think, you know, I don't necessarily know why people love to make a distinction.
It's interesting. I wonder if it's about the anonymity of who we so desperately attach the work to an artist. And that kind of brings us back to the importance of Charleston, because it had so many famous artists making the marks on the wall that it becomes bigger than the sum of its pieces. If that's a group of anonymous people painting a house, it's very different to the Bloomsbury Group painting a house, isn't it?
Yes, completely.
It has it all. It has process and artistic attachment and finished products.
And historical.
And historical relevance.
So it's got the historical value. Yeah, no, it's the whole, it's everything, that one.
It's the whole package.
People love it. It's the whole package, I know.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Decorating Dissidents podcast. It was produced by Decorating Dissidents and supported by Queen Mary, University of London's Centre for Public Engagement. A special thank you to our featured guests. Leo Garbutt is our sound editor and music producer. You can get in touch with us by emailing decoratingdissidents@gmail.com. If you're a fan of the show, please feel free to share it online and give us a follow on Twitter or Instagram.